Tuesday, January 31st, ran all the gamut of emotions. Lyndon had decided that he would go to the funerals of Grissom and Chaffee, and he asked me if I would go to West Point to the funeral of Ed White. I was dressed and ready early, and Freddie Teague came to the second floor of the White House and had a cup of coffee while she waited for me. And then we rode out together to National, where we met Hubert and Patsy Webb and Mrs. George Muller, whose husband is one of the higher echelon in space, and Air Force Chief of Staff General McConnell. It was only a 30-minute flight up to West Point. A bitter cold day, we were met by a very attractive young general named Bennett, and I rode with him up the lovely, winding Hudson Valley to West Point. He showed me Storm King Mountain, delightful name, a part of the Palisades of the Hudson. And as the road hugged its way along the mountain, past great cascades like frozen stalactites, they would be flowing springs in warm weather, beautiful country. And then we entered West Point, and your spine tingled. It was the very home of tradition, a great name in America. We went straight to the old cadet chapel on the ground of the Academy Cemetery. A small, quiet place. Hubert and I and Freddie were seated close to the front. In the first pews, there were Ed White's fellow astronauts, honorary pallbearers, Charles Conrad and Thomas Stafford, and Neil Armstrong, who had been at the White House so short a time before under happy circumstances, and James Lovell and Frank Borman. And then six soldiers, enlisted men, one of them a Negro. It was a long wait. And then the family came in. Mrs. White, so very young, beautiful blonde hair covered with a black mantilla, and Colonel James McDivitt, the command pilot of the space flight in which White had performed America's first spacewalk, gently protective, very military, as he guided her in. And the White's two children, Bonnie Lynn and Edward, and the parents, General and Mrs. Edward White, the general big and solid and tough. I remember them all from that happy visit to the White House, that hilarious time when the Whites and the McDivitts spent the night, or rather until about 3 a.m., and Lucy ran their clothes through the washing machine, and I brought out dresses and coats for them to try on to get ready for their flight to Paris about 4 o'clock the next morning. And there was the astronaut's younger brother, James White, himself a lieutenant in the Army, pale and solicitous. He looked so like Ed that it was heartbreaking as he leaned over Mrs. White. The funeral service was brief and surprisingly personal. Ed White's own minister from the little Texas town of Seabrook, where he lived, close to the Space Center. The West Point choir in the loft sang their alma mater, and then the song of the corps. And I was caught up in the beauty of the voices and the words. Very masculine and military. Later, I'd heard that Ed White had a record of these songs and always played them in times of stress, and Mrs. White had asked that they be sung. And we walked to the graveside. Only the family sat under the tent. We stood with several hundred people, a beautiful view of the Hudson just below on my right. This is a beautiful place. Those who go here must remember it always afterward. The astronauts stood together closest to the coffin. At a time like this, the value of discipline, of tradition, becomes apparent, a strength to lean on, to support. They'd been important in Ed White's life, the Corps, the Church, the astronauts. There is a brotherhood between these men. There was a certain element of strength and beauty in this cruel day. Mrs. White wept softly as they presented her the folded flag from Ed White's coffin. And then General Bennett was nudging me, and I moved forward and leaned over to express our sympathy. She looked up at me quite clearly and almost urgently and said, "Please tell the President that Ed loved him. Now will you remember to tell him that?" Holding on tight, it was almost too much. I went down the line to murmur words to all the family. And to Bonnie Lynn and Eddie, I said, "I have a good picture of you all in a happy time. You remember when you visited the White House? And I'm going to send it to you. One of the best pictures in the living White House is Ed White, young and strong, his arms aloft, poised on the edge of the White House swimming pool. He just tossed Bonnie high into the air." On the way back to the airport, General Bennett told us how Ed White had brought his son, last summer, I believe it was, he was 12 years old, to West Point, to see it through his eyes. Ed White had loved West Point. He held several athletic records, that had never been equaled since. I think the 400-meter race and some sort of jump. I thought, when I get back, I must suggest to Lyndon that he write a letter to whoever will be president at the time that young man reaches the age to go to the academy and request that he be sent. We had lunch on the way back, and Freddie and I talked to the Texas delegation, which has undergone many changes in the brief 6 years since I ceased to be a member of it. And then I worked on the mail with Marilyn and Ashton and went to the beauty parlor and was dressed for the second big event of the day. A very great change of pace, this, and something I had looked forward to for months. The unveiling of President FDR's portrait by Madame Shumatov. We asked Margaret Truman and Cliff Daniels to come up ahead of time, and Lyndon and I had a few minutes' visit with them, during which she told me that no, indeed, her mother was not going to give her portrait, which hung in Independence, to the White House. D. Margaret had her name on the back of it. I asked how we'd best proceed, because I'd certainly like for this house to have one of Mrs. Truman, and she said maybe the same artist would do a copy. If it was a good copy, she, Margaret, would take it and release the original. Look had been doing a story of reminiscences on her. She'd spent the morning in her old bedroom and sitting room, now our family dining room and kitchen. She told of how she'd had two pianos in her room. She often did piano duets with a friend, and how one night late coming in, she and her father had noticed that they were sitting at crazy angles, one end hiked up markedly several inches more than the other. Sure enough, the floor was sinking below them. There were no servants about. They called a couple of Secret Service men and lifted them over on what appeared a more solid portion of the floor. And then the very next morning, President Truman had architects and engineers again going over the place. And after the election in 48, when the Trumans went to Florida to rest, President Truman refused to let Mrs. Truman's mother stay alone in the White House. It was too dangerous. He moved her right across to Blair House. And I went straight to the podium to welcome this roomful of President Roosevelt's family and friends and fellow workers of those vivid years. There are three children, Anna Roosevelt Halsted, John, and Franklin, a dozen grandchildren, three great-grandchildren, and I asked them to stand while the TV camera swung in their direction. And quite aside from the family, there are also many whose names threaded through that whole period. Mrs. Henry Wallace, Margaret Truman Daniel, Frances Biddle, Grace Tully, Tommy Corcoran, Jim Rowe, Adolph Burley, Averell Harriman, and many newsmen and women who covered him. A brief explanation of how, when we first moved in, we had begun to search for a portrait of Franklin Roosevelt for Lyndon's office. For 2 years, it was fruitless. And then Mr. Charles Palmer of the Warm Springs Foundation had brought Madame Shumatov to me, and the portrait turned from dream into reality, and here it was. I introduced her, and Madame Shumatov pulled the cord. That was one of the great moments of the day, and I think I sensed an almost audible wave of approval from this very special audience. Lyndon spoke briefly and very much in the mood of the Roosevelt era. Times of trial can bring out the best in men and in nations. His face and his voice became symbols in that other time of bitter testing, of man's power to overcome. Another line I liked. Like every one of our great presidents, he was also a great politician. He proved again and again that politics, scorned by so many, is an honorable calling. And then we had the entertainment, part of Sunrise at Campobello. On the slightly raised platform, without benefit of stage or props or costumes, Charlton Heston as FDR, and Mary Fickett, who played the role on the stage as Eleanor Roosevelt, and Anne Seymour as both FDR's mother and Missy Lehan. Dora Sherry was the narrator and also played Louis Howe. They told me they had been nervous beforehand. They needn't have been. It was marvelous. I was caught up in admiration and so proud to be offering it to this audience. Then it was over and we went into the Blue Room, which was as nostalgic as you could expect. As Marie Smith said, the White House was filled with memories, both spoken and silent. There was a long roster of cousins and members of his administration, Thurman Arnold, old but full of ginger, and Ed Foley, and Abe Fortas, and Tex Goldschmidt. We'd had such fun the night before, at Abe's with reminiscences of early days in interior and Senator Wirtz, and the Leon Kaiserlings, both of them in FDR's administration, and Gladys Tillett, vice chairman of the Democratic National Committee during FDR's time, well-known White House figures, Roberta Barros and Toy Batchelder, members of the press who had covered those vivid years, May Craig looking remarkably sprightly in a bright pink dress and hat, her trademark, and Bess Furman, whose book about the White House is still a classic, and Doris Fleeson, and Merriman Smith, the dean of the Corps, who'd begun with FDR, but who's just married a very young wife. There were some widows of FDR's officials, Mrs. Oscar Cox, looking very lovely and tearful, and Jane Ickes, remarkably durable, and Mrs. Emma Guffey Miller, age 92, longtime friend of Mrs. FDR's, and National Committee woman from Pennsylvania, and two widows that I had especially hoped would be present and were not, Roberta Vinson and Anita Williams. Aubrey Williams had been head of NYA when Lyndon was in it. Mr. Justice Reed, retired, was going around saying that he's the only one who had been there from the very first to the Roosevelt era. Lyndon corrected him and said, "No, I was here too, although I was just a clerk in a congressman's office." Bob Kentner had been a newsman in his time, writing a column with his cousin Joe Alsop. And since, his career has led along heights and declines and finally back to the White House itself as Lyndon's assistant. I'd ask Mary Lasker and Anna Hoffman and Mrs. Sidney Hillman. A few would still remember that old phrase, "Check it with Sidney." And I was very pleased to have Dr. Wayne Grover, who's invaluable on the library, and the Melville Bell Grosvenors of the White House Historical Association. There were the Almond Hammers, my friends from Campo Bello, and there were a few not at all related to FDR's days that I'd simply wanted to share the evening with. Mrs. Rostow's 87-year-old mother, Mrs. Harriet Vaughn Davies, who's just written her first book, a delightful old lady. Charlie Guy of the Lubbock paper, who was in town for the day, and Esther Mae Brownlee, who'd been Jesse Kellum's secretary back in the days of the NYA, and who was visiting relatives in town. As in any gathering where she's present, Alice Roosevelt Longworth was one of the stars of the occasion, a natural magnet for everybody wanting to hear something spicy. And there was another Roosevelt from that side of the family, Mrs. Kermit, who goes to St. Mark's with me, and a real old-timer, Mrs. Nellie Taylor Ross, who was director of the Mint in FDR's time, and one of the first woman governors. But it was by no means a bunch of old folks only, because of grandchildren and great-grandchildren, and Anna soon had a group of about 20 of them on a second and third floor tour at my suggestion. Lyndon sat on the red sofa in earnest conversation with Dora Sherry, and later with Mayor Bob Wagner, whom he invited to be our house guest at the next state dinner. And then, when the line was over, I took my program and went in search of the stars of the day, Madame Shumatov, who next to me, I think, was the most thrilled person there, to get her autograph. And also all the actors, Dora Sherry, Ann Seymour, who'd played the part of Mrs. Roosevelt on the stage, too, and Mary Fickett. This is twice she's helped us. And handsome, delightful Charlton Heston. He reminisced about the time we were together at the Pioneer Parade in Nebraska. As I look at it, the only one lacking is Mr. Charles Palmer's, and none of it would have happened without him. He had quite a few members of his family, and we all had our pictures made together, as we did with Madame Shumatov's family. And then I went in search of individuals. The Henry Lindsleys, she's Chandler Roosevelt, are two of the most attractive descendants, I think. Isidore Lubin suggested that he take me out to see Reston. John Roosevelt had a wonderful story to tell about a big German police dog they had, rather belligerent, who just loved his mother. And he was in the room when his mother and father were greeting some foreign ministers. One leaned over to kiss his mother's hand. Major the dog misunderstood the gesture, jumped up and ripped the seat out of the minister's pants. The minister was taken to the dispensary for treatment, and all the waiters were lined up in the kitchen to see which one was the closest to the minister's size. Then his pants were borrowed, and he was excused for the evening so that the entertainment could go on, and the minister certainly had a tale to carry home. I spent nearly an hour around the refreshment table visiting with everyone, particularly with Esther May, who has been very ill. How blithely I imagined that I looked younger than my contemporaries, when I see them after an absence of 20 or 30 years. And then, a little past 7, I went upstairs for a few minutes' rest and the third event of this packed day. I changed into my red lace dress and left for Lisner Auditorium a little past 8 to see the Harkness Ballet. It was a benefit for the Indians, and Jane Wirtz was chairman. All good reasons for me to go, but a main one was that Rebecca Harkness had been so kind to the White House and to Lucy. Their honeymoon at Capricorn will never be equaled for beauty and luxury. In the lobby, I met a young Indian girl, quite pretty, and wrapped rather surprisingly in a Spanish shawl. She was Guadalia Lujan, Miss Indian America. Stu greeted me. It was his birthday, and he's off soon for 10 days in the Near East. I was seated between Bill Wirtz and Rebecca Harkness, and I felt almost like I was watching Rebecca's children perform. So intense was she. The first number was called Night Song, with the most amazing lighting effect called in the program Kinetic Visuals. Swirling, circling rainbows of light, with the figures dancing in front of them. Rebecca murmured that somebody had said that's what it was like to take LSD. There was one number that I thought was intensely beautiful, called Abyss. Poetic, delicate, fragile. A young couple that seemed all youth and innocence and very much in love. And then onto the stage there slunk three totter-looking figures, clad in rags and fur, who were the very personification of evil, of violence. It was movingly, crashingly done, from gentleness to brutality. As much acting as dancing, I thought. But the audience gave it only a mild ovation, and then it was proved to me, I don't know the taste of the country, when they gave a wild ovation to a rather conventional dance, lively, attractive, but unremarkable, I thought, called Canto Indio. Afterwards, I went backstage. It always surprises me to find it so grimy and messy and full of ladders and electric lines and such, when out front is such beauty. Met a good many of the actors, tried to congratulate them especially for Abyss, and tried to express my appreciation to Rebecca for what she's doing for the Center for Arts of Indian America, and was wearily on my way home to the White House after a day of grief and nostalgia and pleasant enjoyment. That had been a sort of a capsule from 33 to 67.